We talk about being addicted to all sorts of things, things like chocolate or shopping, your phone, as well as more serious things like gambling and drugs and alcohol. How susceptible do you think you are to addiction? And what's a way out when you're in the grip of one? Kieran Palmer is a psychologist and clinical services manager at the NOFS Foundation. For nearly 50 years, the NOFS Foundation has been involved in tackling the causes and effects of dependence, particularly with young people. Kieran, thank you for joining us in Life Matters.
Thank you, Amanda. Thanks for having me.
Now, what do we really mean when we talk about being addicted to something? How do you know it's an addiction?
I guess the short answer is it's very, very complicated. And that's part of the reason why we've written our book. Myself and my colleague, Matt Noffs, have written our book, Addicted, is to try and have a look at that issue itself, and particularly try and have a look at the term addicted. I think the first challenge that we came up against was the fact that we were trying to write on a subject that is possibly one of the most loaded up with baggage and probably most misunderstood terms in the whole health field, and that's addiction. I mean, we even just say the word and it typically conjures up some pretty dark and pretty frightening images. So I guess one of the key motivations for us in actually writing this book was to really try and pull some of that fear away from the term, to have a look at addictions of all different kinds, to have a look at, I guess, some of the organic ways that different addictions can actually kind of form from exactly what you said.
You argue that our view of addiction is quite narrow and negative. What's an example then of an addiction that isn't negative?
Well, as you say, I mean, most of us carry around a smartphone, and at some point in time, most of us will, you know, if we really sort of sit back and reflect on that, think, yeah, there's probably times that we are on that thing too often, or, you know, where we're sort of charging it at multiple points in the day and thinking, geez, where did all that sort of battery life go? Same with sugar, same with coffee. But one of the things that we actually explore, and one of the ideas that we explore in this book, is the idea that the addictive process is actually something that's quite natural for human beings. That whole idea of getting sort of hormonal and chemical drives to continue a behavior that gives us some sort of reward is something that we've done for centuries as human beings. It's something that sort of continues or allows us to continue doing pleasurable things. And, you know, we've always had the challenge of trying to manage that so that those pleasurable activities or pleasurable substances or whatever they might be don't sort of go too far and then start to overtake things.
Would you call falling in love like an addiction? Well, an addiction?
Well, it's I guess the idea behind why we wrote about that in the book was to try and demystify the whole thing. As I sort of said, I mean, it's addiction is such a loaded term with sort of frightful images. So that sort of juxtaposition of you know, falling in love, and how could that possibly be a bad thing, and how could that even be an addiction? But when we sort of have a look at just some of the, I guess, side effects, or maybe not side effects, but some of the behaviors and sort of thought processes and emotions that go along with the idea of falling in love, or even, you know, starting a new sort of exclusive relationship, or that kind of courting process, the flirting process, or that, you know, starting a new intimate relationship, or whatever form it sort of takes.
Well, the idea of being overtaken and overwhelmed by this feeling, I suppose, and this need.
Well, and some of the specifics as well. I mean, you look at things like we start to develop cravings, both emotional and physical cravings for closeness with that other person. We start to develop a tolerance. We might go through some withdrawals when we're away from them. And we do start to get those sort of blinkers on. We get that sort of tunnel vision, whether it's from somebody who's, say, drinking too much, who starts to let slip other things in their life, like perhaps family or work, through to someone falling in love that might have a group of friends who they're not seeing as often, and they're getting the comments from the friends, you know, what, where did you go? We don't see you anymore. We're certainly not suggesting that falling in love is as destructive as, say, a heroin habit, but some of the, I suppose the mechanics behind it are actually quite similar, and certainly some of the biology behind it and the way our brains kind of process these sort of things, it does have some striking similarities.
Yeah, and it does give you a way into understanding deeper, darker addictions, I think, too. Also joining us now is Nicole Lee. Nicole is a psychologist at the National Drug Research Institute at Curtin University. Hello, Nicole.
Hi, Amanda.
Now, if addiction is something that can affect any of us and not necessarily negative, as Kieran's saying, when do you as a counsellor and researcher say, okay, now there's a problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an individual determination. So some people can use a lot of alcohol and a lot of drugs and not have any problems. But when it starts to become a problem and interfere with their day-to-day functioning, that's when we would consider it to be an issue for that person. That may not be dependence. That may just be overuse, for example. But it's really individual and really comes down to when it starts to affect that person's functioning.
Yes. What then are the risk factors, Nicole, for someone developing a serious addiction to something in a way that does get out of control?
So it's a very complex mix of circumstances that kind of create a perfect storm that would result in dependence. And there's a range of kind of internal risk factors, so things like genetics and temperament and mental health in your family background and vulnerability, you know, some vulnerabilities around that. And then there's some external factors. So, of course, the alcohol or drugs themselves, some are more addictive than others. But things like a lack of parental supervision, availability of a drug, growing up in a lower socioeconomic conditions, poor engagement with school, all of those things are also risk factors for developing alcohol and drug problems later on. And then there's a whole range of other things like mental health problems. So trauma. Yeah, for example, trauma particularly is one of the bigger risk factors for dependence.
Yeah. Kieran, I noticed that, well, Nicole, I notice you're tending to use the term dependence, and Kieran, I think you use addiction. Kieran, is there a sort of particular reason either way?
This has been a debate that's gone on for quite some time in the field, and it's interesting different countries around the world and how they use the term. In Australia, typically the terms are somewhat interchangeable, dependence or substance use disorder or addiction can be used sort of interchangeably. I guess one of the reasons that we've gone away from the term addiction in Australia a little bit is because of the stigma that it's loaded up with, and that stigma can really be harmful for a lot of people who perhaps do have experienced some more serious or significant issues with different substances and who could most probably use a little bit of support. It becomes incredibly difficult for people to kind of put their hand up, because of terms like, oh, you're an addict or you're a junkie and that sort of thing. So, we've sort of introduced terms like dependence to try and sort of counter that. And I guess one thing that we wanted to do with this book was kind of claim the term back a little bit, that it's actually, it does have these really negative connotations associated with it now, particularly in sort of mainstream society. And I guess our argument is, well, we don't actually think it needs to.
Mm. Well, look, let's hear from you now on this subject of addiction as well. Matthew Crawford's here too.
Yes, hello. Denise has texted us, I'm addicted to communicating with the ABC via text message.
Yes. Good on you, Denise. That's one of the positive addictions.
Exactly. Thank you for clarifying that one. Now, but turning to a more serious note, Hannah says, a fanatical addiction to exercise has saved me 1,000 times as a bipolar sufferer from self-harm. So an addiction to exercise has helped Hannah there. That's an interesting point.
Well, and another one that she would call a positive addiction.
Yes, yeah. And another person too, food addiction is the most problematic problem in the West. Ask a dietitian how successful they are at helping people lose weight and keep it off. Now, I want to invite a call from Eric, who's calling from Cairns. Now, Eric, you've told us that you were addicted to alcohol and smoking. You gave up smoking a long time ago and alcohol a lot more recently. Could you tell us which one of those was harder for you to go through?
Oh, right. I think the smoking was harder because you'd still have, even years later, have that twang and you'd smell a nice back and you have that desire to have a smoke. But once I was over the first week, well, I figured, well, you know, I can go without turning back.
Yeah, and you've more recently chosen to put alcohol into your past. What led you to that decision?
Well, I'm a grey nomad, and so my social life is happy hour with people at 4 o'clock around the country. And I got to the stage where if I cracked a bottle of wine, I finished it. Mm-hmm. And then I got the stage of opening another one. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't feeling really well, and I felt that my drinking was masking something.
Mm. So what do you drink at happy hour now, Eric?
I have a cup of coffee. And the people at happy hour, they just accept that. Normally, no one says, no, wouldn't you rather have a beer? No one says anything like that. It's just because we're all in the same sort of age group, and they realise that they have trouble dealing with their problems too. And if I've gone to coffee, in some ways they're supportive.
Yeah, good on you. All right, well, go well on the road, Eric. Good to hear from you. Let's go to Lynn now, who's in Sydney. Now, Lynn, you decided to give up both alcohol and coffee. Which was the hardest for you?
Probably the coffee, not because I felt I was addicted, because I was just looking at improving my overall health, and I thought they'd be two things that would be advantageous. And I was really very surprised. I only really had one cup of flat white a day, and I was really surprised at how hard it was to give up the coffee, just the one cup a day, and how both those activities, it really made me aware of how intertwined they are with our social life. And so, like your previous caller, I went to having soda, lime and bitters. That was quite an easy thing to do. The coffee wasn't so easy because so often people say, let's have a coffee, and I didn't really want to buy a herbal tea when I was out. And yes, it's such a social thing. And also now the weather's become cooler and I was still trying to do it. It made me have great empathy with people who try and give up maybe much more serious addictions, because it's such a hard thing to do. And now the weather's cooler, it was easy to swap a coffee for a cool drink. Now the weather's cooler, and I think to myself, well, I really still don't want to go back to that habit that I had. It's a hard thing to do. So it's really given me a lot of empathy for people who have any other sort of I suppose, habit or addiction that they're trying to kick. It's really so often part of our habits, I think, not just the physical addiction.
Yeah. Good on you, Lynn. Thank you. Great to hear from you. And here in Life Matters, it'd be good to hear from you too on this subject. If there's been an addiction in your life, how has it impacted on you? Also keen to hear if you've been able to break it and how. Do please post on Facebook. Nicole Lee from the National Drug Research Institute, if I can come back to you, is breaking an addiction always about complete abstinence from the activity or substance?
No. It does depend a little bit on how severe the dependence is to start with. And someone who is severely dependent, we do recommend at least some period of abstinence, 6 months to a year before they try drinking or social drug use again. But a substantial number of people who have problems with drugs and who are mildly or moderately dependent can go back to drinking or social drug use. It really is an individual thing.
And Kieran, for you, in terms of the clients you see, are there some people for whom abstinence will be the only way? I mean, can you think of clients, for instance, for whom this has been the only solution?
I can. I absolutely agree with Nicole. I think with this sort of thing, and indeed with most issues in the health field, and I mean, we would certainly see addiction and drug use as part of the health field and not part of the criminal world, for example. But as with many things, there is no sort of one size fits all. Different treatments respond to different sort of people, and I think that issue is probably even more important in my world, because I'm sort of immersed with adolescents. So the work we do at the Tednos Foundation is primarily with adolescents and young people and children in some cases. And I mean, we work with kids as young as 12 years old. And that's not to say that they've developed, you know, full-blown addictions to heroin or ice or anything, but often the drug use is starting to emerge at that point for a variety of different reasons. And I think realistically, I mean, we'd be sort of crazy to think that, you know, in half a decade's time, these kids are going to be having their 18th birthday and that, you know, we're expecting them to never, ever touch anything again. I think it's just a bit unrealistic. So as Nicole says, it's very much an individual thing. I've certainly worked with some young people who have just made the decision that, you know, no more. I can't have anything. As soon as I do, it just gets out of control straight away. But at the same time, I've worked with plenty of young people who decide to to try and cut down or control their use. Or I mean, a common one is to abstain from certain things and try and control others. So for example, you know, I never want to touch, say, the drug ice again, but I might want the occasional drink with my mates, or I might, you know, want to smoke cannabis occasionally with my mates. And so it's about sort of working with that individual, working with their support networks as well, and trying to come up with realistic plans and realistic strategies for them.
Well, Kieran, from your experience of working with those young clients, are they more susceptible to addictions because of traumatic events in their backgrounds? This is what Nicole was saying earlier.
Yeah, we certainly work with a lot of trauma, probably even more than what we're even aware of. Of course, we can only be aware of the trauma that we know about, and we also know that a lot of it sort of stays underground. It's so difficult for people to actually talk about these sort of things, and that's, I guess, organically one of the ways the book kind of evolved. We obviously had this idea, you know, we write a book about addiction, and our first challenge was, well, how do we do that? It's such a massive topic itself. But the more and more we kind of looked into it, and the more people we spoke to, and the more we kind of sat down and looked at this, we thought, you know what, at the core of everything that we do, you know, beyond the literature on this and beyond the history of addiction, it's the people that we work with. And the more and more people that we spoke to, and the more that we looked, you know, in our own backyard at the young people that we're working with, trauma just kept coming up over and over again. And so what we try and do in the book is to really dig a little deeper with that. I think there's a prevailing understanding that some people who have been through different sorts of trauma, like sexual abuse or family domestic violence or neglect or homelessness, child homelessness and that sort of thing, is that, you know, drugs are a great way of numbing painful memories, and they're a great way of forgetting things. But it goes far beyond that. A life of trauma can actually change the way that a person, not only a person's brain develops, but a way their whole physiology develops. It sort of changes the way that their mind and their body and their whole sensory world kind of talks to each other. And the problems of yesterday don't just stay in yesterday. People don't just jump in a time machine and go back in time, back to the abuse. They suffer here and now, today. It's the world that they live in today that's often terrifying and extremely confusing. People can find it so difficult to understand how they work, let alone trying to get on with other people. So we really try and dig a little deeper into that to try and, I guess, increase a bit of an understanding of just how difficult these sort of things can be and how difficult everyday processes can be, like impulse control and you know, trying to say no to tempting things and that sort of thing. And where drugs and alcohol and other behavioral sort of addictions like gambling and sex and food and whatever else, how they really kind of fit in nicely with that picture and how these things can sort of develop. And then we try and just offer realistic tactics and realistic strategies for anyone to use. I mean, this book really is aimed at anybody, from people with serious addictions all the way through to parents who are just concerned or worried because they see those Ice Destroys Lives campaigns on TV and they're terrified that that's going to happen to their kids.
Mm. And the title is Addicted, Addicted with a question mark by Kieran Palmer and his colleague Matt Knopfs. Nicole Lee, as a psychologist, if you have a client whose addiction is based in trauma, is getting them to confront the trauma through counselling the path out?
The treatment for trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, is quite specific and highly technical and requires a specialist psychologist to respond to that. So in the alcohol and drug sector, we treat the drug and alcohol problem, but we just hold the trauma and understand how that interacts with the alcohol and drug problem. But we'd probably refer to someone who was a specialist to treat that trauma because it is a very traumatic treatment to go through as well for people to relive those trauma experiences.
And Lara is calling from Sydney. Now, Lara, there's someone in your life who has gone through an addiction and that's affected you as well. You've told us that's your partner who was addicted to pot, marijuana. What were the steps that you had to go through to make sense of that in your life?
So what actually happened was 6 weeks before we initially got together, he had tried to completely cease smoking pot. We were together for a year. And he actually was lying to me for 4 months, telling me he still wasn't taking it, but he had. He then broke up with me almost a week before our anniversary. And I told him, look, this is depression talking. You've been socially isolated and I'm just essentially going to be here once you've gotten yourself a bit better.
And so was that the prompt that he needed to address? Because you mentioned the depression. Was that the prompt that he needed to address that?
Oh, definitely. And it took him a while to really come round to getting that sorted, and he still struggles with that today. But almost a year to the day when he broke up with me, he came back and said, can we try again?
Mm.
And it's something he still struggles with, and whenever he gets down, he ends up with cravings. And we actually sit down, we talk about it, and we work through what it is that's actually bothering him, causing him to go back to that behaviour.
Yeah, you've worked out some tactics to help manage it. That's
Lara,
wonderful.
He's lucky to have you. Yeah. Let's go to David now, who's in Melbourne. Now, David, through one of your children becoming addicted to alcohol and drug, you believe there's misinformation around about addiction. Tell us about it.
One of the problems, and I apologise if I'm misinterpreting what I've already heard, but there's a massive and fundamental difference between habituation and addiction. My daughter, younger daughter at the age of 14, my kids grew up overseas. I don't live in Australia, but I'm Australian, as you can probably tell from my accent. But at the age of 14, she became addicted to alcohol and drugs. She's 31 now. She's been 2 years clean, but I had her in and out of clinics both in Australia and overseas, and most of them were useless because what they did was to get her clean, by putting her on prescription drugs, and then she'd leave the facility, and within 24 hours she'd be back on ice, heroin, alcohol, and so on. And I thought I'd read up pretty well everything there was to be read on the nature of addiction, but it wasn't until I got into a facility where they treated the family members as well as the person who was addicted, that I learned certain things. For example, like many people who are listening who have family members who are addicts, it's probably ruined their marriage as it ruined mine. It's impacted the whole family, and a couple of the biggest lessons that we learned. And my daughter, one of the turning point for her was when she ended up in hospital because of the swelling in her legs, and she was told by the doctors that they'd probably have to amputate because she was shooting up into the groin. And that was when she realised that if she was going to turn her life around, she had to do it. There was nothing we could do. We used to call her our project. You know, we were going to save her, and we learnt the three C's. You know, you didn't cause it, you can't control it, and you can't cure it. And it's a horrible lesson to learn, because you have to face the fact that you have to, in the end, you have to
let them do it.
Yes, and by enabling, by having this notion that you can actually do something about it, you're actually just enabling them to continue with this monster.
Yeah, but, David, it's a hard lesson to learn, though, as a parent, that's for sure. Thank you so much for your call.
And a very quick one from Lisa, who's calling from Brisbane. Lisa, you've told us that you are now clean after a 17-year ice addiction. Lisa, how did you kick that?
Yes, hi. I think the main thing was that I'd, you know, reached rock bottom. I'd lost, you know, a very good government job. I'd lost my children, I'd lost houses, I'd even died because I was given the wrong substance instead of ice. It was heroin. Mm. And I took too much and had to be revived. So I lived through that. But then again, I still continued with my ice addiction. And it wasn't until, I guess, that, the threat, there was child safety intervention. Mm. And... you know, it wasn't until, the threat of losing my children really shook me awake.
Yes, it can be, I guess, taking yourself out of yourself and thinking about others, your children in your case, that is something that can be really, I think, powerful in getting out of the grip of something so powerful. Lisa, thank you for that. Kieran Palmer, with an addiction, just briefly, can you how do you manage cravings?
There are a few ways and a few suggestions and a few tactics that we sort of go through in the book. One idea that we go through in the book is actually a theory that was developed by an American psychologist a number of decades ago called urge surfing. Urge surfing, that's right. So one of the typical things that people do when they're craving for anything, but let's take drugs as an example. So someone who, say for example, is a problematic drinker, they're trying to cut down, there will be a point during the day where they start to feel cravings for alcohol. It might be triggered by, you know, the time that they normally start drinking or an activity that's usually associated with drinking. And the mental ideas that go with that is that the craving starts to increase, and it will just continue to increase until a point where it's just completely unmanageable, and that the only option is to succumb to the craving and have a drink. And what the idea of urge surfing talks about is that the reality is a little bit different. Than a craving will get triggered by something. It will increase for a time. It will then plateau at some point and then start to diminish, similar to waves on an ocean.
Hence yeah, so it's like surfing. Right, so it's a so wave that will diminish, so you have to just let that wave pass over you. Look, we need to wind it up here. I'm sorry to sort of cut you off a bit, Kieran, but it is something that is also talked about in the book, Addicted, by Kieran Palmer and Matt Noffs. Kieran is a psychologist and clinical services manager at the Noffs Foundation, and Nicole Lee is a psychologist and adjunct professor at the National Drug Research Institute at Curtin University. Nicole and Kieran, it's good to have you join us. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thank you very much.
And many thanks to you for your calls and comments. And yes, I'm sorry we haven't had time to get to all of them. If you have something you do want to add, you can post on Facebook, or you can also text, and the SMS number is 0418 226 576. You're listening to Life Matters.